Cowan. Part two, please.
As with their pretrial preparations, counsel's voir dire strategy was so uninformed and poorly executed that it rendered Sergeant Akbar's entire trial unfair. Specifically, counsel knowingly engaged in a strategy that would and did produce a biased panel with no countervailing benefit to their client. The strategy counsel employed was not reasonable in Sergeant Akbar's case for four key reasons. First, to the extent the strategy is ever reasonable, it's only valid when members won't be replaced and when there isn't a fixed panel size. Second, Sergeant Akbar had a fixed panel size of 12 to 15 members once the panel was reduced to 15 members. Third, counsel never considered their ability to replace members and still have a 15-member panel when that opportunity was right before them. And fourth, counsel's unreasonable strategy resulted in the seating of biased members whose presence was directly contrary to other aspects of the defense case. And specifically, we believe the members who are most illuminating as to the bias of the panel are Sergeant First Class Davis, Colonel Quinn, and Lieutenant Colonel Gardeke. With Sergeant First Class Davis, this member refused to consider evidence of life history, which was a key feature of the defense mitigation case, and demonstrated by the evidence counsel introduced and the instructions counsel requested the military judge to give. As the Supreme Court stated in Mills v. Maryland, it's well established under the Eighth Amendment that the sentencer,
Can I interrupt you for a second? You said one of your arguments was that if they had dropped below 15, they could have gotten back up to 15. Did I understand you to say that?
No, if they dropped below 12, Your Honor,
okay,
but you replenished to 15.
But one of the tensions they're dealing with is they're playing this ace of hearts strategy. And so they want as many people on the panel as possible. And so there's a tension between challenging off people as you go from 15 to 14 to 13 to 12. Is there any way they can replenish and get back up to 15 if they don't get down to 11?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, in this case,
under you understand the question?
Yes, Your Honor. The question is, was there a danger that they wouldn't get to that 11-member mark to be replenished? However, here, that opportunity was sitting right in front of them. Here, the panel was reduced to 15. There's nothing counsel was going to do about that. However, they still waived their peremptory strike. They waived the statutory disqualifier of Sergeant First Class Davis, and they chose not to join the government's challenge of Command Sergeant Major Huffman. That would have brought them to 12. They also had good grounds to challenge Major Seawright, who the government also challenged on other grounds.
Just to be clear, so your answer to my question is, without getting into the particulars, is they still would have had to get it down to 11, but in your view, they could have. Not that there was some mechanism when they're at 14, they can't file a motion and get the convening authority to put another six out on the table.
Correct, Your Honor.
So they had to get to 11.
They had to get to
11. So your argument is their error was not getting down to 11, rather than they didn't use mechanism 94.A, which lets them go back to the convening authority and get additional members.
Correct, Your Honor. There wasn't that mechanism. However, just under the facts of the case, based on the voir dire they conducted, there's virtually no chance they couldn't have gotten to 11. There's so many members on the panel that they could have challenged. Plus, as I mentioned,
well, that's the issue, whether it was reasonable to take that risk or not.
Correct?
Your Honor.
Okay. What's patently unreasonable is for counsel not to consider that as a possibility. And here, it's clear that they didn't.
Well, counsel, even if we were to agree with you that there was a problem with impaneling the members, how do you get around the fact that it appears that the evidence of premeditation during the findings portion was overwhelming?
Your Honor, that would be irrelevant if they seated a biased member. In this case, both the military judge, for example, had a sua sponte duty to exclude members for both actual and implied bias. And as demonstrated by the Sixth Circuit cases we submitted, if there's actual bias demonstrated on the record.
The rule doesn't impose a duty, does it? It says he can.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right, and that's what 912 says.
But that language is similar to Article 66C, where this court has stated that it doesn't accept equity.
Are you arguing that it's a structural error in that case if there's actual bias, or do we look to whether it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
It's structural error, Your Honor. There is no such thing as a fair trial in this country when there's actual bias with members with actual bias on the panel.
Well, isn't that where we give the most deference to the judge in cases of alleged actual bias? And we give less deference in cases of implied bias?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
However, I also would point out that in addition to this court not recognizing equity in the military justice system, U.S. v. Strand laid out that the military judge does have a sua sponte duty to remove members for actual and implied bias. And this court specifically said that that is not dependent on the trial tactics of the defense counsel. Furthermore, the President of the United States under RCM 912F4 specifically stated that the military judge's ability to remove members is not predicated on a failure to challenge a member or a waiver of a challenge of a member. So it's clear that the military judge does have that duty and that it can't be viewed as part of the defense team, essentially, in going along with whatever.
Are you going to go through each of the members you wanted to focus on and indicate what was their bias or actual bias and or what questions were defense counsel failed to ask? You please do that?
Yes, Your Honor. Sergeant First Class Davis is actually biased. He specifically stated that he would not consider evidence of the accused's life as mitigation evidence.
And feel free to cite the specific record pages and quote.
I believe it was record 632 and 635, where defense counsel asked if he had any interest in the accused's life, how he got to that point, and factors that might have influenced his decision. Sergeant Davis's response was, no, sir, because if they took the life, it wouldn't be important. Later on, counsel asked him, what else would you consider choosing between death and life without parole? And he agreed to consider mental health, rehab potential, and whether the accused was provoked. However, at no point did counsel or anybody else ask him further questions about his refusal to consider the accused's life as a mitigating factor in this case. As the Sixth Circuit pointed out, when there's an unambiguous statement of bias on the record and it's not clarified, and the military and the judge does not remove that member, it is IAC for counsel not to object or remove that member. And here, again, as the Supreme Court stated in Milton, Maryland, the sentencer may not refuse to consider relevant mitigation evidence. The President of the United States, under RCM 1004, requires the members to at least consider all evidence of mitigation. And here, the military judge, in fact, instructed, pursuant to the defense counsel's request, a number of mitigating factors related to Sergeant Ackerford's life.
So, just to be clear, you're not saying that the ace of hearts strategy that was employed by trial defense counsel was unreasonable. You're saying its application in this particular instance was unreasonable.
I think generally it's a horrible idea, Your Honor. However, in this case, it's clear that counsel didn't think it through. They didn't see their ability to do something better, which was to provide their client with a fully vetted panel.
Is the standard then that you're applying, though, is that we, with 20/20 hindsight, can look back and say, you know, now that we've had an opportunity to reflect on this, the better approach would have been to get it down to 11, bounce it up to 15. Aren't we really looking at what they were confronted with as they're in the heat of battle working on this case about whether or not their conduct was reasonable?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's exactly what I'm asking this court to do. Look at the record and see what was sitting in front of them. There was no question that they could have churned this panel. They could have gotten new members, brought it back up to 15, and given their client a far greater chance of finding the ace of hearts than they did. Instead, before trial, they made an arbitrary decision that, hey, it's always better to have more members, and so we're going to engage in a superficial voir dire and do what they did, which is essentially try to rehab members rather than really find out their biases. and keep them on the panel just for the sake of keeping a number, because there's some possibility that this person would vote in their favor. That is an arbitrary decision, and it's one of those, it's a decision.
Is it an arbitrary decision, or is it a tactical decision?
It is an
arbitrary. Or a strategic decision?
Your Honor, it's an arbitrary decision if it is then executed without fully considering what the members say and making and looking at what their options are at that point. It's council can't make decisions in the absence of facts. There's no tactical decision to make in that case. And here that's what they did. They decided to jump in the pool head first and didn't think twice even though there was no water in it. So for that reason, it was...
Go ahead and please continue going through your members and TikToking them.
Yes, Your Honor. And Colonel Quinn was the president of the panel, who is a friend, neighbor, and colleague of Colonel Hodges, the victim and government witness in this case. He said their kids played together. Also, Colonel Quinn was one of 10 members who knew that the accused had allegedly stabbed a guard before trial. He was one of 2/3 of the panel who knew this.
Hang on for a second. In the earlier part of oral argument, there was some debate between counsel as to whether they knew he had stabbed or whether they were aware of something that had happened. In your view, what did the 10 know or not know? Did they specifically know that there had been a stabbing, or was it a case where some had said there was something that happened, I didn't read up on it? I have no view on this. I want to know what your view is as reflected in the record.
Your Honor, at least one member stated that he knew that there had been a stabbing involving scissors. What Colonel Quinn stated he knew was that there was some sort of scuffle at the courthouse, and he saw MP cars arriving on the scene because his office wasn't far from there.
That's Quinn.
Yes, Your Honor.
You had 9 others to talk about, if you wish.
And Colonel Garpy.
What's the name?
Lieutenant Colonel Garpy, Your Honor.
Garpy. Okay.
He stated that he had only heard about a scuffle. I believe he saw a headline, and he said that's all he knew. But counsel didn't do any follow-up to see what he meant by a scuffle, and he also didn't confirm that he would set aside any knowledge he gained in that respect. And that is Lieutenant Colonel Garpy. Also, I believe it was Lieutenant Colonel Turner said he saw a headline about the scuffle at the courthouse. Sergeant Major Huffman, who apparently violated the military judge's order in reading an entire article about this issue, read that the accused had overtook and injured a guard 1 week before trial in the Paraguay. Counsel never asked him why he violated the military judge's order. However, the government did challenge him for cause because of his inability to follow instructions, which the defense counsel objected to and the military judge denied. Master Sergeant Chung heard that there was a new news report that the accused overpowered a guard. Sergeant First Class Cascason stated that he heard a radio report that the accused overpowered a guard. Sergeant Major Rivera heard others say that the accused stabbed a guard in the neck during movement. Colonel Meredith, the second ranking member of the panel, heard that the accused had assaulted someone with scissors a week before trial. Those are the individuals I have notes on. I apologize if I skipped warning that. However, the government's assertion that all the members didn't know exactly what happened in this case is simply wrong. It's not correct at all. And furthermore, when counsel do a superficial voir dire,
does hearing about, because that's what you've got a lot of these, hearing about a scuffle not further defined constitute actual bias?
No, it doesn't constitute actual bias.
Okay.
It can't constitute implied bias. The problem here, when the counsel decides to engage in a super...
Well, how could it constitute implied bias? Usually goes to relationships and command structure and that kind of thing. If it's not actual, how can it be implied?
I believe it's implied bias if we look at the totality of the circumstances. especially if we look at particular members, but also if the panel, two-thirds of the panel overall, is aware of the static incident, that should be incorporated.
Well, that wasn't my question, though. My question was how it can be implied.
I believe it can be implied bias because the panel member in a capital case who's aware that the accused had stabbed one of his guards.
No. I wasn't asking about those that allegedly knew about the stabbing. I'm talking about those who had heard about a scuffle without further definition.
Oh, yes, sir. I apologize.
Yeah.
For those people who simply stated a scuffle,
yeah.
The record wasn't fully developed to determine what they meant by that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what they meant. And I believe both the defense counsel and the military judge had a duty to learn about that. What do you mean when you say scuffle? Who was involved? What did you see exactly?
So what you're really saying is they didn't follow up in Bordire with
yes,
regard
sir.
To these guys.
Yes, sir.
Oh.
And I refer to this court's opinion in U.S. v. Richardson, where it's discussed that the military judge, when an issue of bias is clearly raised, the military judge does have a duty to follow up on there and develop the record further so that this court can determine and the public can determine if there is an implied bias issue.
Now, the military judge knew that trial defense counsel were pursuing the ace of hearts strategy, correct?
No, Your Honor, not that this record reflects. There's no mention of it at all in this record. The military judge seemed to give great deference to the defense counsel's objections, including members, but I've seen no mention of it at all in the record. Even if he had, I think that would be irrelevant to the analysis because, as this court stated in Strand, the military judge cannot be his sua sponte duty cannot be tied to the defense counsel's trial.
I'm trying to come up with the members that you think would have easily or should have been tossed off. You had Davis and Quinn, and with Quinn, his son played with Colonel Hodges' son.
Their children played together, Your Honor.
Or his children, and he was aware of the scuffle, but you've indicated that applied to most of the members in your view.
Yes, Your Honor.
So is that it on Quinn?
I believe Colonel Quinn is established a supply bias on the record, not only because he's the panel president, but because there's no further follow-up to discount the fact that people in his position would feel biased if they sat and listened to a friend of theirs, a neighbor of theirs, whose kids they see apparently every day, discuss the fact that the accused tried to kill him and members of the unit commander. It's difficult to believe that a person in that position would not feel biased. Also, Lieutenant Colonel Garvey is a significant concern. He referred to Muslims as passionate, emotional, misguided, and easily influenced and too rigid on his panel questionnaire. During the voir dire, he only confirmed what he said on his panel questionnaire by stating that he believed it was a selfish religion. Also, Colonel Garvey asserted that future dangerousness in prison was an important factor in his sentencing decision. But despite that, counsel did confirm that he wouldn't consider the scuffle he mentioned earlier between Sarnak and guard. Furthermore, counsel never satisfied or confirmed that he could set aside his derogatory opinion of Muslims for the duration of his trial. And that's particularly puzzling in this case because, first of all, counsel's client's name is Hassan Akbar. Also, it's contrary to the defense counsel's later decision to admit the accused's entire diary, which was filled with extremist Muslim ideology, which is entirely consistent with Colonel Gardeki's derogatory opinion of Muslims as a whole. Furthermore, having Colonel Gardeki on the panel was directly contrary to defense counsel's stated concern of opening the door to the stabbing incident.
Is your argument here that there is enough on this record that he should have been excused for cause or that there was a duty to ask additional questions?
I believe there's enough on the record currently to determine him actually and implied the bias. And yes, I do think counsel should have asked additional questions.
What should they have asked?
In particular, when he When he was asked if he could be impartial in this case, notwithstanding his view of Muslims, he stated that it shouldn't make him impartial. Counsel apparently concerned with that answer asked him to explain. His explanation doesn't even make sense. It's non-responsive. He discusses considering himself fair-minded because he learned in sports to be not be a sore loser. And he carries on about a paragraph discussing not being a sore loser. The last thing he says, and to think about things fairly. And counsel simply asks, okay, so that's how you're going to look at the evidence in this case. He said, yes. But his agreement to that.
And what would the reasonably sound counsel have asked at that point?
I think reasonably sound counsel would have pinned him down and said, sir, we need a yes-no answer. Will you set aside your derogatory opinion of Muslims in this case or not? He never did that, and neither did the military judge. And that is alarming. It is alarming in this case, but their client, they know who their client is. They know what the government's going to put up in this case. They know what the government is going to put on a PowerPoint slide at sentencing, but they do nothing, even to confirm that he can set aside his derogatory opinion of all Muslim people. That establishes actual implied bias. If he can't answer a straight-up question, that further confirms actual bias, and it certainly confirms his implied bias, particularly here where the counsel doesn't even follow up and confirm that he can't set aside the scuffle for the duration of trial and not consider. They never asked him that. And I see I only have a few minutes, and if I could, I'd like to turn to AE3. In particular, I'd like to focus on the government counsel's improper interpretation of the military judge's weighing instruction. During its argument. Consistent with their performance throughout this case, counsel stood idle as the government misconstrued the military judge's instructions and directed the panel to arbitrarily weigh the value of Sergeant Akbar's life against that of his victims. There is no reasonable tactical decision for this because counsel specifically identified that threat before trial, asked the judge to give corrective instructions so that panel would not do this, would not misinterpret his weighing instruction, and yet when government counsel, specifically referencing the military judge's Gate 3 weighing instruction, misinterpreted it in this way, they did nothing. They didn't object, and they didn't follow up later on and ask the judge to give the instruction that they previously had requested, specifying that victim impact evidence is not to be used to balance the life of Sergeant Akbar against the life of his victims, which is precisely what the government told the panel in this case they should do. Now, that the government's...
You said they asked them precisely to compare and weigh. What's your record citation for that, please?
Your Honor, I look at Joint Appendix 1474, after describing the military judge's weighing instruction, the government counsel said, what you must decide is what life is worth, what two lives are worth, what a military career is worth, what the use of your legs are worth, what a little boy's life without his father is worth. You must weigh all of that against the evidence Sergeant Akbar has presented. Then later on...
Now how does that show... That's just the value of the victim's lives. That's not... comparing the...
Yes, Your Honor. Later on, I'm sorry, that first quote was from 1468. At 1474, government counsel then says, weigh his life, referring to the accused. That's what you're doing. You're weighing his life against what he did, what he caused, and set in motion forever. However, if he's already told the panel that what they're doing with that aggravation evidence is using it to make an arbitrary determination of what the victim's lives are worth. That's what's in the aggravating side of the scale. So when he asks them to weigh the evidence of aggravation against his life, what they're asking is to include the arbitrary life evaluation that they've already asked the panel to determine.
Now, you refer to it as an arbitrary determination, but isn't that precisely the function of that panel and the merits phase of a death penalty case.
That is absolutely not what the panel is supposed to do, Your Honor. And in fact, the South Carolina Supreme Court.
They're not supposed to consider the damage, the injuries, the effects of the actions of the accused?
Yes, sir. That's what they're supposed to consider, the facts and aggravation and mitigation, not to come up with their own arbitrary evaluation of what a life is.
It sounds to me like when you recorded, when you stated what trial counsel argued, that that's exactly what a trial counsel argued. And then six pages later, he made some allusion to the accused.
No, Your Honor. What they said was, you must determine what a life is worth. That is not an aggravating factor under RCM 1004. It is not an aggravating factor under RCM 1001.
What the victim's life is worth?
Yes, Your Honor.
They're not to consider the victim?
They're not to make a determination of what the value of life is. No one can place a moral value on what life is worth.
It's a capital case. What are they supposed to do?
I thought your argument was one of comparative worth.
It is, Your Honor.
Not...
But that's not
the
what trial counsel
victim,
said.
Which is an aggravating circumstance.
But I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because what they did was, they come up with this arbitrary evaluation that they're supposed to put on the victim's lives. Then they say to waste our act martial law. So they misconstrued the military
victim. But it's the comparative worth that is the foundation of your argument, or is it talking about the life of the victim at all?
Talking. Your Honor, I apologize. I see I'm out of time.
For my question, you always said no. please answer.
Yes,
yeah, as long as those questions will.
As the South Carolina Supreme Court noted in Hall, in Payne v. Tennessee, the Supreme Court pointed out that victim impact evidence is fine to show that the victim's life was unique and it's a unique loss to society. The same thing the accused can do with mitigation evidence. However, in Payne, the court also mentions impact evidence is not to be used to show that one victim's life is more important than another because that a victim may be a pauper, for example. It's even more inflammatory if what they're asking to do is determine the value of the victim's life and then to weigh certain actors of life, as opposed to looking to the facts and aggravation and mitigation and weighing those.
You've answered my question. Are there other questions? You will have time on rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Counsel for the government, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, I'm here to address assignment of error 3 and 4. For assignment of error 3...
Could you speak up a little?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
You might just want to pull the thing over.
Pull the thing over.
Yeah.
Is that better?
Thank you.
For assignment of error 3, this deals with the victim impact sentencing. The government did not run afoul of Payne during its examination of witnesses or during its sentencing argument. As this court just noted, under 1001b4, the prosecution may always present evidence of aggravating circumstances directly relating to or resulting from the offenses of which the accused is convicted. Importantly, in this case, witnesses were not asked for their opinions or to characterize the crimes or the defendant, which would have been in contravention of Payne and Booth. Likewise, trial counsel did not argue in contravention of Booth, Gathers, or Payne. He relied upon properly admitted victim impact evidence, and he did not invite the panel to do anything more than what they are required to do.
So just to be clear, you're saying you don't disagree that the law says no comparative worth as between the victim and the perpetrator, but you're saying as a matter of fact that's not what occurred in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. The government's position is that if that had happened in this case, either witnesses had testified to those types of value judgments, or the trial counsel had argued that in closing, then yes, there would be a problem. But the simple fact of the matter is it just didn't happen. Trial counsel argued well within the bounds of the law, and he relied upon properly admitted evidence, and he did not invite the panel to do anything more than they are required to do with the sentencing evidence before imposing the death penalty. That is, they are to take all of the victim impact evidence, and they are allowed to put some value on that. What they're not allowed to do is to weigh the value of those lives against a defendant's life or an accused's life. That's where the problem is. And when witnesses make that type of comparison, or trial counsel invites them to make that kind of comparison, that's where you have the problem. But that simply didn't happen in this case. This was an emotionally charged case, and the victim impact sentencing evidence reflected that. The trial counsel's questions were very carefully crafted, and although it didn't come up very much during this portion of oral argument in the brief, appellant also points to their argument is essentially that the trial counsel argued that he was a traitor, this was treason, or his acts were treasonous, and that witnesses essentially testified to the same thing.
Didn't he call him the enemy?
He did, Your Honor. And that's because those were the facts of this case. I would invite this court's attention to...
And that's not inflammatory to the panel?
Your Honor, it is potentially prejudicial, but it's not unfairly so. I mean, this was a highly inflammatory, very prejudicial, emotional crime. This was an accused of part of a unit who murdered his fellow soldiers on the eve of battle in Iraq. The facts of the case indicated that when the victims in this case, when this first occurred, they actually thought it was someone from outside of the wire. They thought it was really the enemy, whoever that was, attacking them. It was only later on that they discovered that it was, in fact, one of their own, one of their fellow soldiers who had perpetrated this attack. And that's why when the trial counsel in this case asked all of the, and I would say to the court that it merits looking at who trial counsel asked this question of, or these two questions. It was only asked to victims or to family members of the murder victims. It was, when did you find out this was an American soldier, and how did that make you feel? That's perfectly acceptable, because those were the facts of this case.
I'm talking about in the closing argument, when he made the references to Akbar as the enemy. That's how he referred to him.
Yes, Your Honor, because that was simply the fact of the case.
He could refer to him in many different ways, but the enemy, to me, he was not a member of the enemy force.
Yes, Your Honor, but he became the enemy.
And how did he become the enemy?
Because he attacked his fellow soldiers, and they in fact thought it was an outside enemy, but it was an inside threat. It was the enemy from within.
So he may have been a murderer.
Yes, Your Honor.
But does that make him an enemy, as that term is defined when armies are at war? Was he acting under orders from the foreign government?
No, he was not. I would say that once again, that was the theory of the government's case. And it is prejudicial, but the facts of this case are very prejudicial to the appellant. He murdered fellow soldiers on the eve of battle. These were soldiers who went to war prepared for an outside enemy, not prepared for an inside enemy. And in Payne versus Tennessee, the Supreme Court said that even though a defendant is entitled to individualized consideration, he cannot receive that consideration wholly apart from the crime that he has committed. And the crime that was committed in this case was the murder of fellow soldiers. He became the enemy. And that is why that was perfectly appropriate to ask those victims and the family members.
What about when trial counsel asked the panel to punish Akbar for his hatred?
Your Honor, once again, those were just the facts of the case. That was...
No. Is that an appropriate ground for punishment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is he charged with a hate crime?
He was not charged with a hate crime, Your Honor. But he evinced a hatred of his fellow soldiers, and that is why he committed the crime that he did. That was the evidence of trial. Trial counsel was simply asking them to take the facts that have been presented for them and to use them in a way that is acceptable during sentencing, to put all of that into context. It's difficult to make a sentencing argument in a case like this without putting some emotion into the sentencing argument.
He can't be punished for his hatred. He can only be punished for what he did.
Yes, Your Honor.
For the crimes and the elements. So, isn't your better argument that probably was an improper argument, that it was harmless in the overall scope?
Yes, Your Honor. That to the extent the trial counsel did say anything that was inappropriate in his sentencing argument, on the whole, these were isolated comments that were not prejudicial, were harmless.
Turning to issue 4, did counsel have specialized training in death penalty voir dire?
Your Honor, their affidavits indicate that they went to some training, and that they also consulted with other attorneys who had conducted capital litigation, and that they had been trained on something called the Colorado method, and that they were employing a strategy essentially deemed the ace of hearts.
Is that the Colorado method, or is that something else?
That looks to be something else, Your Honor.
Well, in plain English, what is the Colorado method?
Your Honor, I'm not entirely familiar with what the Colorado method was.
But for our purposes, then, it's the government's view that they're engaged in the ace of hearts strategy?
Yes, Your Honor.
And
they went to so much trouble to keep this scuffle out, and they got the judge to keep it out. And then they turn around and let, and don't exercise challenges, don't even follow up in voir dire, when it became clear that most of these members at least had some inkling of what had happened. What's reasonable about that?
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree that defense counsel didn't follow up with these members. Any member who indicated that they had some knowledge of something that might have happened, defense counsel asked them, the questions were asked very open-ended. What have you heard about in this case? So as not to plant any seeds, just to hear what the members had heard most recently. And the next set of questions was, for any member who said that they had heard something, defense counsel did a very good job of asking them whether or not they believed everything that they read in the media, whether or not they had actual knowledge of any of this, whether or not they'd ever been exposed to things that didn't end up being true at the end of the day, and whether or not they could rely just on the evidence that was presented in court. And importantly, in this case, evidence of that never came out during the merits or during the sentencing. So,
did they ask for an instruction to the effect that whatever any member had heard about this could not be considered?
Your Honor, not in my review of the record.
They didn't.
And once again, I don't believe this is covered in the affidavits, so I'm...
Well, I mean, it clearly was a big worry, and it should have been, when your client does something like this in the week before trial.
Yes,
but it just seems curious that that's all they did.
Well, Your Honor, I would...
They didn't ask for a continuance when it happened. They didn't. And it seems to me that I would have thought they'd at least want the judge to instruct, but maybe they didn't want to call attention to it.
Well, Your Honor, that was going to be my point, that defense counsel's strategy appeared to be attempting to make sure that no one had actual knowledge, and then to the extent they had any limited knowledge, to minimize that, to make it for those members to seem as such that perhaps this was just rumor or there was nothing to it. And if none of this ever comes out during trial, then the members are left with the impression.
Well, I doubt they thought they ended up thinking it was rumor because it was in the base paper, wasn't it?
Your Honor, there was something, some members saw something in the paraglide about it, but most members...
Is that the base paper?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Do you agree with the appellant that once they drop below 15, the only way to get back up to 15 is to go down to 11?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's a tension in the system that once the convening authority stocks the pool with 20 or 15, they either have to, and they're playing an ace of hearts strategy, they either have to get all the way down to 11, or they destroy their strategy if they challenge one or two people for actual bias. So let's stipulate that they're doing ace of spades, or whatever it is, ace of hearts, they're playing cards. And someone gets up and says, I can't possibly be fair in this case. Let me just state for the record that I'm biased. And they're doing ace of hearts. So they have a problem, because if they knock that person off, they're down to 14. They have to get all the way to 11 to get back up to 15. Correct?
Correct.
So what is the government's response to whether the system is in contrast to the civilian system, where there's a large pool to pick from? They're between a rock and a hard place. Do you agree they're between a rock and a hard place, which is not legally conclusive? You can agree to that. It's a description, not a legal statement.
Yes, Your Honor. Because of the way the panel is seated and because of the way substitutions are going to work, defense counsel does have to make choices going into voir dire. Whether or not that's fair is nothing that was briefed in this case, but it appears the court is considering that.
The court is merely asking a question about whether there's in fact a tension. I want to make sure I understand, and the parties have the opportunity. I did not think there was a way of replenishing the pool.
No, Your Honor, I'm not aware.
Other than to get all the way down to 11.
Yes, Your Honor.
It does create an incentive to not challenged fully, and then there's a lot of pressure on the judge not to knock that last 12th person off, even if they get up and say something ridiculous, which is not necessarily this case. But it does raise a systemic problem, does it not?
It does, Your Honor, if you assume that a military judge is unwilling to do that because he doesn't want to go through the hassle of seating other panel members. I mean, the difference between our system and the civilian system, obviously, is the qualifications of panel members. I mean, we just have a different selection system. So, in theory, you're supposed to end up with people who are most qualified. I mean, that's the criteria, and there's a bunch of things the convening authority is supposed to look at. So, as compared to seating a civilian jury, I guess we're supposed to be better at this because we're supposed to be able to pick. We're essentially supposed to do a first round.
So Article 25, then, in your view, is the safeguard for this tension?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, how do you explain the email from the trial defense counsel to Dr. Walker where they said that they didn't feel that the stabbing incident was significant and that they could deal with it?
Your Honor, if I could have a moment, I'm not...
It's on JA 2286 and 87. And, go ahead.
Yeah, take your time. Yeah. Do what you need to do.
Your Honor, my response to that would be essentially to look back also at the defense counsel's affidavit, GAE-1, and they did discuss this, and their concern was if they put any further delays on it, on the case, they were worried the government would go ahead and charge this. And by the time of that...
That's not the same as what he said in the email, which is he said that this incident would be of limited impact. And that's different than saying we're worried about what the government might do later on.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, and it ended up being of limited impact, I guess, because of trial defense counsel's strategy, which was to move quickly to trial to avoid having the government charge it, to voir dire the panel members to ensure there was not actual bias, and to the extent any panel member had heard anything, to go through a line of questioning that was designed to plant the seed that what you may have heard is not actually true. And importantly, most of the panel members didn't really know very much. I mean, to say that all the panel members knew that there was some kind of stabbing incident is a bridge too far, if you will. Most of the panel members said something to the effect of, I heard there was a scuffle, I heard there was an assault, some sort of altercation, and I'm just reading quickly from the quotes from these different panel members. Reference to a scuffle, altercation in the courtroom. I believe that there was only one panel member who actually knew anything about an actual stabbing. And this is of all the panel members who knew anything about this particular incident.
But we don't know what was discussed in deliberations.
No, Your Honor, we don't. We do have to rely upon the panel members. We do have to rely upon them when they said to the judge, and this is an actual bias question, so he's in the best position to assess their demeanor when they say to him, or in response to defense counsel questions, which is, are you only going to rely upon evidence that's presented in court? You understand if something's not on the charge sheet, it's not for your consideration. All the panel members agreed that they could follow the instructions and that they would only consider evidence that was presented in court.
What about the member who evidenced alleged religious bias?
Your Honor, Colonel Garfield did indicate on his questionnaire and was followed up with defense counsel about his views on Islam or Muslims. What I would say to this court is that it's although troubling, it's not actual bias, and it's nothing that should cause this court to question the fairness.
In a case of a fragging that took place in the Middle East with evidence of religious motivations, it's not relevant.
Your Honor, I wouldn't say it's not relevant. I would say that it's nothing rising to the level of would give anyone pause to think that the appellant didn't get a fair trial. And that's because of what Colonel Gardner actually...
Well, is that because he's only one out of X or what?
No, Your Honor. It's because of what he actually said during the voir dire process. He talked some general feelings about the Muslim religion, but he never said anywhere in his voir dire that he thought they were hate-filled, murderous, likely to kill their fellow soldiers. He talks about it's a male-dominated religion, maybe they're sometimes selfish. I mean, his responses are... They do not tie in to the facts of this case. And really, this case was never presented as religiously motivated. I mean, in closing, during the sentencing argument, that was one of the things the trial counsel said, is this is not a case about religion. This is just a case about hatred. This is about what he did and his motivations, but it was not tied directly to religion. And just as the defense counsel, we heard a lot of discussion about their trial strategy. It wasn't to put into evidence a lot of his family story, which would have brought out some of these, some potential radicalization at the hands of other family members. It was really about, he has mental illness, he has mental health problems. In our system, we should not execute someone, even if they are mentally responsible for their crime, we should not execute someone who has mental issues or a mental defect. And, Your Honor, I would also point to the fact that the Colonel Gardeby, whereas he might have had, he might have evinced some statements, I think, that were properly remedied by the defense counsel as he continued his questioning. He also had an older sister with organic brain disease, and that was one of the things that defense counsel, that came out during the voir dire process. And the same can be true of almost every panel member on this particular panel, where they might have said one thing that might have been a reason or would have been a basis for defense counsel to challenge them. Every single member that remained on that panel had said some things during voir dire that were extremely helpful for the defense. So we run into this problem in Samoy in the concurring opinion. The judge there talks about, it's the Air Force case, the judge talks about how if there's IAC in that case that he's going to find, he comes very close in terms of defense counsel essentially kicking too many people off the panel. And just running through a quick list of these individuals, Colonel Quinn had a former sister-in-law with bipolar disorder. Colonel Meredith, when he was younger, felt the death penalty was wrong, didn't think it was particularly effective as a deterrent. Colonel Ellis said, I don't believe it's appropriate in all cases. Colonel Foy's mother was pending a sleep study and testing for sleep apnea. Colonel Turner had a close friend hospitalized for severe depression. The appellant talked a little bit about Sergeant First Class Davis. When asked about what sort of factor would influence decision as whether to choose between life or death, he said, for instance, say that person was provoked. Any other factors, he said, unless they had a mental condition or anything. It's important when you talk about Sergeant First Class Davis mentioning, well, it would be important to him if someone was provoked. In the original part of voir dire, when asked about, you know, had he heard about this incident when it first happened, he said what his response was, you know, his chain of command must have really ticked him off. That was his thought when he saw the news story initially about the murders. So then you link that back into his subsequent answer on voir dire, what's important to you in terms of, you know, why would you choose to impose the death penalty versus life? And he says, well, if the person was provoked. It's easy to see why defense counsel, in sort of their own totality of the circumstances analysis, coming at this overall with the idea that, you know, numbers benefit us. The more people we have, the more people the government has to convince to put to death. And then secondly, looking at every single one of these members, you can't look at them through the lens of just one answer. There was a lot of answers that were given during voir dire, and a lot of things were very helpful for the defense. If the defense had challenged some of these members, we might be standing here litigating whether or not it was IAC to not leave them on the panel. That might have made a different result. Also in this case, the question is raised as to what duty does the military judge have to sua sponte start disqualifying members because of their answers during voir dire. And this court has, in previous cases, indicated that, yes, there is a sua sponte obligation. That's tied to the public's perception of fairness about a particular trial. In Velez, though, this court said that sua sponte removal of a panel member is a drastic action. In this particular case, drastic action, no such drastic action was required. And the question becomes, essentially, does an appellant get the panel of his choosing, or does he get one that all of us, after the fact, look at and decide, well, we don't think that was fair, and we're worried that someone in the public, even if they're familiar with the military justice system, would not think that was fair. And I would urge this court to adopt a standard where as long as defense counsel has a reasonable strategy and they implemented it, they should be given some deference.
Was the military judge aware of the Ace of Hearts strategy?
Your Honor, he wasn't, and that's the danger in this case, is that if the military judge takes on that duty to such an extent that he starts undermining a an objectively reasonable defense counsel strategy on voir dire, then do we have a situation where the defense counsel has to have some kind of ex parte with the judge? Oh, by the way, this is what I'm going to do during voir dire. Please don't mess this up for me. I think this could be important for my later IAC claim, or I feel like this is going to be the best method for my client. I've been trained in this. Other people have told me about this. Other counsel have done capital cases. And that's where the danger is that even to the extent that any of these members might have had grounds for challenge, defense counsel was well within their purview to not challenge them because, first of all, their strategy overall, and secondly, because individually a lot of these panel members had once again given statements and indicated that things were going to be important for them in determining sentence that the defense counsel knew were going to come out in their case.
Wouldn't they have been better off having a 39A and telling the military judge that was their strategy so they wouldn't then later be second-guessed on appeal?
Your Honor, I think that would be an unworkable system. I mean, we don't have that many capital cases in the military. There could be other strategies that happen even in non-capital cases. I mean, most military counsel are sort of familiar with the general numbers game that is played, you know, because of the way math works, that certain numbers favor the accused and certain numbers favor the government.
But the problem with your argument is that you're saying the military judge should take a step back just in case this strategy is being employed and not follow the duty that they normally would have to monitor the members and potential biases.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. If that's what the court is hearing, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the way the system is workable right now, and there should be a different system for capital cases. Velez says sua sponte removal should be a drastic action. And all I'm saying is that it should be a drastic action. And in this particular case, because sometimes we hear the phrase death is different and we want to give additional procedural protections or other protections to an accused in a capital case, this court should not look at the voir dire process and the challenge process any differently than any other case. And this court has been hard-pressed in other cases like Blocker and Velez and Strand to find that the judge erred when he did not sua sponte remove a panel member. And whether in those cases, you know, the charges are much less serious, the challenges for cause are much less serious, if you will, and much less varied than they are in this case, but the simple fact is nothing more is needed. Because the other thing is that we do have a defense counsel that was employing a strategy that, once again, based on a numbers game, does favor their client. If the government has to convince 15 people to impose the death penalty, that's a lot harder than having to convince three. In this case, they couldn't ever end up with less than 12, but even so, you just want to keep that number as high as possible on the off chance that someone holds out. In this particular case, as this court mentioned, there was reconsideration proposed in this case. Now, we don't know what the reconsideration was to go up or down, but you know, there's some indication that the panel did struggle on sentence, which could be an indication that the defense counsel's strategy was, in fact, a reasonable one. And I would also say, just finally, the military judge and the defense counsel, not only overall in terms of strategy, but just on the particulars, neither of those were just sitting back during voir dire. I believe that the phrase in Strand is asleep at the switch. The defense counsel in this particular case questioned all of the witnesses. He joined in on a few of the government challenges where it was clear that the government was going to prevail. He also opposed certain challenges for members that we would assume he found favorable to him, like Colonel Van Heusen, who said when he was younger, you know, I had opposition to the death penalty. I've changed my opinion now. One can see why the defense counsel would want to keep that particular person on the panel. And they also challenged Major Brooker, who had actually been involved in apprehending Sergeant Kreutzer. One can see why that was a logical challenge for the defense counsel. And the military judge in this case, he questioned multiple of the panel members about many of the issues that had been raised in answers to questions during general voir dire and then in the individual voir dire. At the end of the day, Your Honor, the appellant can't hide from the facts of the case. That's what came out during sentencing and during the panel selection process. The appellate defense counsel were looking for the ace of hearts, and that was an objectively reasonable standard. Pending your questions, that is all I have.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, rebuttal, please.
Thank you.
Judge Olson, I was told I may have misspoke in stating that counsel can make a tactical decision to seat a biased member. That is not our position. We don't believe there's counsel may ever make a tactical decision to knowingly sit a biased member. And regarding tactical decisions, in this case, counsel stated before trial, as indicated in their affidavit, that they were only going to challenge clearly biased members. However, unlike what the government asserts, they did not ask sufficient questions even to make that determination. And that is clear. For many of the members in this case, but in particular, Sergeant Davis, Colonel Quinn, and Colonel Gardeke. Again, counsel never followed up with Sergeant Davis to verify that he could consider life history if instructed. Colonel Quinn, they asked no questions at all regarding his relationship with a victim in this case. How many times the kids come over? Do they have social interactions? Do the wives interact? They asked no questions on that point. And Colonel Gardeke, again, they didn't confirm that he would set aside his derogatory opinion of Muslims, or even confirm that he would set aside the information about a scuffle in this case. So those decisions were not tactical. They were made in ignorance. Therefore, they are not tactical decisions. And Chief Judge Baker, you mentioned the propriety of a system that encourages defense counsel to engage in this sort of strategy that they did. And I want to point out that we did raise that head note plea at Bravo 8, asserting that it was unconstitutional to create this encouragement for counsel to do this. In fact, we believe it makes a mockery of the military justice system to state that in a capital case where the Eighth Amendment applies, that somehow this can be a legitimate strategy. In the cases where we have to be most certain that both the findings and the sentence are correct, that this strategy of shot in the dark just to get to as many panels members as possible can be acceptable. It can't be. At some point, whether it's the military judge or counsel or somebody has to life qualify this panel, has to ensure this panel doesn't contain members who are actually or impliedly biased, and specific to the Eighth Amendment, ensure that these members will not automatically vote for death and, relatedly, will agree to consider all aspects of mitigation and extenuation. They must to sit on that panel. So if it's nobody's job to do it, then whose job is it to protect the rights of the accused in the military justice system before we kill him? That's an important question this court needs to address, and hopefully you address it in Sergeant Ackbar's favor. In closing, counsel's lack of capital experience and training is evident at every point in this case. Counsel failed to actively lead or participate in the mitigation investigation. They failed to prepare witnesses before trial. They failed to present a coherent case in mitigation through lay witness testimony. They failed to prevent the government from making improper sentencing arguments and failed to protect Sergeant Ackbar's fundamental right to an unbiased panel. Because of these errors, this court cannot be confident in the outcome of Sergeant Ackbar's trial and must order a rehearing. If this court disagrees that this case should be overturned based on the record before it must, at a minimum, remand this case for further fact-finding regarding the sufficiency of defense counsel's pretrial investigation and preparations. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. No more questions. Thank you. The court thanks all of the counsel, and we now stand in recess until tomorrow morning. Thank you very much.
Court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning. Thank you.